Wayne Curtis with Jeep's Blues. He's on tenor sax. Nat Adderley on cornet. Wynton Kelly on piano. Sam Jones on bass. And Belton Evans on drums. This tune, incidentally, was written by Johnny Hodges and Duke Ellington. And it's from Curtis's 1960 album, Soul Meeting. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and we continue our discussions on the trial of Derek Chauvin in Minneapolis. Chauvin, as you know, is the ex-cop who is in the central spot, the central figure in the killing of George Floyd in a botched arrest on May the 25th last year. Expert witnesses have testified about proper police procedures for arrest and restraint as a counter to Chauvin's contention that that ridiculous move that he made, that horrible, horrendous, and illegal move that he made by putting his foot on the neck of George Floyd, was in fact quite legal. And more than that, that it was among the tools that the police academy had made available to police officers to use in specific and extreme circumstances, and he believed that he was in an extreme circumstance. So in order to restrain George Floyd, he decided to employ that move. Witnesses also have testified pointedly that that use of restraint is strictly outside of the training in the police academy. You know, we're not covering the case as it unfolds, you know, contemporaneously with the case unfolding, because, of course, we come on at a different time. But we have been, if you've been following us closely, we have been using this trial as a jumping off point for other related and very important discussions relating to how the police operate in our communities, who's watching them, who is keeping tabs on them and their conduct in the community, and so forth. And today we have another question that will soon be posed. I just wanted to get that said, because as you observed, if you have been following the discussions, the trial is proceeding. As it proceeds, it gives us an inside view that we do not normally have. The issues that the police are grappling with, the questions that arise out of how the police are regulated, their presence in the community is regulated, and in fact, a lot more in ways that we don't normally discuss. What is the state of affairs with police departments all across this nation? They're not saying much about this question because, of course, it cannot be an open issue that many police stations and precincts are very unstable because things are not right among the police themselves. They have matters that have gone unresolved, racial issues that have gone unresolved, and issues relating to how they function in particular communities, especially communities of color. You would notice in this trial so far that they've invited people from the profession to speak. And that is to be expected, to testify about procedures and so forth. You notice that we haven't gotten from the trial so far a picture about how the people see the presence of police in their communities. Are they enjoying a good rapport with the police? Are they aware of issues with the police? And this question came to my mind because when police executives, for lack of a better term, were testifying about the use by Chauvin of this most unorthodox method of restraining people who were targeted for arrest, it dawned on me that we have no sense of relationship between precincts or police stations or police personnel with communities. And that came through pointedly when, as an explanation for why they needed to hurry up, was that it was said time and again that the police felt threatened by a growing crowd trying to observe their conduct, trying to observe how they were treating George Floyd. And they actually used these words. They felt threatened. I heard mention of a growing mob. And I couldn't believe that they were talking about the community, members of the community, that they were working in, earning a living in those communities. It was as it came across with such contempt to describe people who obviously were very, very upset at what they were witnessing. And by their physical presence, they felt that they could make it stop. And certainly by their physical presence, they were trying to communicate to these wayward cops that they were under direct observation and they were there to bear witness to what was happening. Instead of seeing it that way, instead of having a sense that, well, these are people who are very concerned. These are people wanting to know what is happening with this man in our custody. What message are we giving them? What are we sending out to them that would cause them such anxiety? Rather than think that way, they said they felt threatened by this growing mob. And that immediately brought to my mind, if you could think of neighborhood people that way, And you could think of an institution in the community where these people work. You could think of it that way. What is the reason? What accounts for that? And how is it that it doesn't appear to anybody in a position to make a change about that, in a position to address that? How is it that it just went unaddressed? And what then are we to think? What is the arrangement? Are these people our servants who think this way? Are these people worthy of being in our community? Do we deserve people who think this way about us? Let alone the treatment accorded to one of us. And nobody finds a relationship between that and what has happened to George Floyd. Nobody makes that connection. Are we just simply the means? We, meaning the community, the people of color community in particular. Are we just a convenience for a place to put an institution from which people earn a very respectable living, but they hate us? They have no respect for us. They do not care about us, and yet we have to live with them, and yet they're not at all shy about expressing their feelings. And in this way, with George Floyd, their grotesque feelings about us. Should we live with this? Is this to be the future of policing in our community? So far it has been. I mean, for all the years that many of these police precincts have been in our communities, that has been the attitude. Nobody really would like to remain working there, but, you know, they don't qualify for anything else. And truth be told, it pays well, benefits are great. It allows them to realize the white American dream of buying a house and raising children and sending them to college and all of that. But the bones are made in a community you despise. You don't like it being there. Should we reconsider this question, and should we have an accounting, an auditing of attitude? Do you want to be in this community or not? Do you like being here or not? Should we send you packing? Go wherever it is you feel more comfortable. Because we certainly are dying to have you here. You're killing us while you're here. You're not being a genuine help to us. And in way too many instances, you express and show contempt, open hatred. Calling concerned citizens a growing mob, a mob. Who is acting like the thug here? The guy with his knee on George Floyd's neck.
And the fellow officers protecting him because they too believed, as Derek Chauvin believed, that there's a mob gathering. They might kill us. They might harm us. They might do something to us. So there is no love there for the community. And there is no knowledge of or about the community. That is not necessary. They show up to get their paycheck, to do their job, and go home. Meanwhile, we don't get a sense that anybody is routinely keeping their fingers on the pulse of these centers, these military centers in our community, how they're performing, how they're functioning, whether they even like their jobs. We don't get a sense that there is a serious effort to subject every single person working in a police station in our communities. Who are you? What do you think about people of color? What do you think about reporting to work here every day? So this is the way we have existed for decades. The people and the community, separate and unequal. This would have been a great time to call upon members of the precinct council, the people who try to be the kind of bridge between the community and the police. Ask them, how is it that nobody even knew about Derek Chauvin's cute little method of restraint? Did he try these methods on white people? How come nobody knew about this? We now have to look more closely at how, on a day-to-day basis, this local military slash police organization was functioning in a community. We could hardly believe that what happened with George Floyd was the first time it happened, or that it will have been and will be the first time it happens. Who's in charge? Who's policing the police? I'll take this break now and come back to your thoughts as you address the question. Who's policing behind that blue wall of silence? Who's policing the police? We get to that question when we come back. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and we're asking a question today that should have occurred when we saw what we saw. And it should be, there should be evidence that it's on somebody else's mind, the people who run things within the police department. Ed from Queens, you start us off today.
Hey, good afternoon, Eutrice. How are you?
Okay, Ed. How are you?
Well, you know, my infamous my infamous thumbs and myself hanging on.
Good for you.
In reference to your question, I mean, as far as minority community, African American community is concerned, nobody. The police themselves. I mean, they've always had a juxtaposed occupying army in different precincts pertaining to relations with the African American community. It goes back to the foundations of the police department, the slave catcher clans from the South, and the constabulary from England. Police used to be paid, just like the firemen. If you wanted service, you had to pay them. And they were roving gangs of before they became incorporated and a part of the city and the state structures. But police, they were paid. Like firemen had to be paid. They'd watch your house burn down. You had no money to pay them. So, I mean, we've got to reinvent what community policing means, what community security means, and the things that lead to crime. For since I've been alive, the dog whistle or the bellwether of the Republican Party and of many politicians has been crime and black people. Crime and black people. We got to keep them under control. We got to keep them in order. We got to keep them in line. And police officers have that as part of their credo, as part of their training. It's us against them, the blue wall. We're the defining line. We're the last. We're at the gates, and the barbarians are at the gates, and we're holding the gates. And as long as that mentality prevails throughout the essence of policing, we're always going to have these problems. I remember Columbine. I remember when those two young men shot up the school, and they were running out in the forest trying to get away from the police. And one of the deputies was giving an interview, and he said, you know, I drew a bead on them a couple of times when I was chasing behind them, but I couldn't shoot. And the reporter asked him, well, you know, they just did this horrific crime. They just killed several people in a situation. How come you didn't take them down? Well, every time I drew a bead on them, I saw my son. You know what I'm saying? That's the mentality they have towards each other. When they police in their own communities, they don't look at us against them. It's, I am facilitating a need in my community. These are my people. That's my son. I couldn't shoot him no matter how horrific a crime he did. I couldn't take him down, even though he was carrying an automatic weapon and I drew a bead on him. I thought of my son. They don't think about that when they see us. They think about that's the enemy and we got to contain the enemy at all costs.
Are you surprised that none of these questions are arising anywhere? I haven't seen anybody come to the subject. Although it is clearly hinted at, there's a reason, I think, for us to start asking questions emanating from the trial, because they're telling their truth in a court of law, and they expect to be understood. And I'm saying, well, wait a minute. How you're calling experts? Regular people are not experts. The people who bear the brunt of this kind of conduct, they're not experts.
Well, what I think is going on with the trial, to the best of my estimation, I think they're trying to bring a laser focus on the fact that there was a procedural, there was an error in what this officer did, Trayvon, what he did. And they're trying to concentrate on that. I don't think they want to open up the scope to indicting policing the institution as a whole, because that's a large thing, and you can get pulled away from the essence of the fact that this man committed murder on George Floyd. That's what we have to if I was the prosecutor, that's my concentration. I don't want to get too big or too vast, because I don't want to lose the jury.
I understand, and it's a very strong point. Yeah. However, what if you were to present people who knew the different Derek Chauvin? What if there were people in the community who knew of his methods?
Well, I mean, that's something that a good prosecutor would do. You have to canvass the community.
Yeah. So it's not that strange to expect that, you know, make an effort and see whether throughout the community, Derek Chauvin is known as a psychopathic cop and had a history within the community of showing it. He had a history of it.
Well, that should have been done from the get-up. I mean, any decent prosecutor would be, listen, let's canvass the neighborhood. Let's find some incidences. Let's look at his record. I mean, especially with the specious coroner's report. That would have been my first order of business. Well, who is this guy? How does he interact with the community? Does he have a record? The relationship he had with George Floyd as far as being a bouncer, his moonlighting. All of these things would be, if they weren't raised, then that brings me back to my constant point. A DA ain't nothing but a cop with a law degree. And you can't let the fox guard the hen house.
Well, thanks for your contribution today. Bill from Brooklyn, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, Utrice, and to all in the audience.
Yes, thank you. Good afternoon to you.
You're welcome. Oh, in regards to your question about who controls the police, I have to take issue with the previous caller. It's not the police. It's those chamber of commerces. It's those business leaders. It's all of those folks involved in those former smoky backroom sort of places where they would gather, you know, in the middle of the night and play cards with each other and decide what is going to happen in particular communities, legal and unlawfully, throughout their jurisdictions. And so the police are just mere pawns in this larger game, which unfortunately you have to say it's a game, but in a sense that it is, that has been going on from day one. And in a sense, with the whole Floyd situation, as well as the Trayvons and all the others in which the police have been involved, I was thinking about this. I see it in a way, and I don't mean to be facetious, but it's kind of a public sort of theater of terror that police inflict on the community deliberately. The police officer in the Floyd case knew very well what he was doing. He was performing sort of a political, sort of public, sort of, for lack of better words, art for the sake of the underlings that he was supposed to be in charge of. He was teaching them. He was teaching them how to demean, how to kill in the presence of the community that were the passive actors to absorb, you know, this message of this is what happens. This is what I can do. This is what I'm teaching others to do. The people in the community, they know about the police officers there. They know that they're terrorists in many sense. Not all of them, but certainly in the case of the officer whose name I can't think of right now, they definitely knew what he was about. And the way he was so comfortable in leaning on Mr. Floyd's neck for 9 minutes and 20 whatever seconds with his hands casually behind his back, knowing that the community was looking and that were powerless in a sense. I heard something from on the radio the other day from Cornell West, and which I had to agree with him. And I think in terms of where this incident with Mr. Floyd occurred, there are other places in this country where that could not have happened and people would have remained passive and not have intervened in a physical way. And so police know their communities, and in this situation, this officer knew that people would not intervene. So that's what that's my perspective on things.
I mentioned yesterday a decisive moment for me in the way I think about ex-officer Chauvin, and it was a photograph. He was looking dead at the camera.
Yes, I remember.
And you saw the move he made was he had his hands in his pocket to signify he was calm and casual about the fact that there was a dying man literally at his feet.
Right.
And he seemed to communicate such utter disregard and disrespect, and at the same time, a kind of victory. Look what I could do, and you can't do a damn thing about it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And during the first part of the trial, they showed photographs of Mr. Floyd in the ambulance. And what struck me so to my heart was the humanity of this man laying there in the ambulance. And he was basically dead. And you just saw this man whose life had been taken away, and the paramedics were trying to revive him, but he was already gone. And I think his humanity comes through so poignantly in that ambulance photograph, and something I'll always remember.
Thank you. Good to hear from you today, Bill. Thank you. Henry,
thank you.
From Chicago, you're on the air.
Hey, Utrecht, how's it going?
Oh, it's going.
All right. Oh, we're okay. It's warm today, about 80 degrees today in Chicago, so that's a surprise.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I know. But I wanna bring this thing to a Chicago perspective, and I want to bring your attention to what you were saying earlier about the relationship between the police and the community. Well, here in Chicago, there is no relationship between the police and the Black community, and even particularly the Latino community neither. But there was a task force that was just formed a couple of months ago. It was called the Chicago Police Safety Community Task Force. The task force basically is supposed to not only bring safety to those high crime communities, but also form relationships with the police and the community. Well, one of the people who was assigned to the task force, an officer, I think his name is Jason Task, I think that's his name, but he was filmed almost over a year ago by somebody who was basically filming officers, and he basically told the guy on film that he kills MFers. And so this is the guy who is on your safety task force and supposed to forge, you know, community relationships. Now, his status is up in the air now if he's still on this, you know, task force. But, you know, I'm wondering, you know, why is this guy even a cop? Because records show that he did kill somebody in the line of duty in 2014. So I'm still wondering, you know, we're all still wondering why, you know, he's still a police officer with a badge. But also, too, Utrecht, I don't know if you remember, but about 2 months ago, I told you that there was a significant jump in carjackings here in Chicago. And, you know, it was a concern to a friend of mine who owns a security company. And he also lives in one of these neighborhoods where the carjackings was significantly increasing. So we put a call out to a lot of the black men, and basically what we did was, and including me, which we formed a, you know, we formed a community watch teams in different neighborhoods in Chicago where all these carjackings was happening. So we've been doing this for like the last 12 weeks now. And needless to say, and great to say that the carjackings have gone down. Not only that, that the crime has gone down in these communities as well. But we get reports from some of our members of the watch team that now they're being followed by Chicago Police Department. So in a sense, we're being threatened because we're trying to, you know, step in and do our part. And before anybody starts to go crazy and think that we're vigilantes, none of us are armed. We don't go out and arrest folks. We are neighborhood watch people. We've been trained to understand if there's an escalation and if there's gunplay, we bring the police in on this. Our only job is to just make sure that if we see a situation, we try to de-escalate it if it's nonviolent. But if it gets to a point where there's violence or there's gunplay, we call the police. We're also, you know, we've also been trained in, you know, basic medical stuff and CPR and handling gun wounds. So just in case somebody starts to go crazy about, you know, we have a vigilante gang out here trying to stop folks. But the whole point is, that's the relationship we have with the police. We have men out here stepping up, trying to help out with the crime, you know, to de-escalating crime, and we get followed by the police. So that's our relationship in Chicago with the police.
Wow. What is happening in the way of direct talks with local police leaders?
Well, I am not a part of that. The guy who started it, he does go to CAPS meetings. He has a few good relationships with some of the sergeants and some of the precincts that we do neighborhood watches in. And from my understanding, when I talk to him, there is a tension going on between the black police officers and the white police officers. Now, we get a lot of support from the black police officers. They actually commend us for doing stuff like this because, you know, we don't have to do this. You know, I sometimes do some of my duty on the watch during the weekday, but very few. But most of the time, I'm just doing it on Saturday. But, you know, obviously, you know, a lot of us, we have families, we have other things that we have to do. We don't have to do this, but we want to do this because of the fact that we are concerned about what's going on in this city. And unfortunately, we don't feel the love of all of the Chicago policemen because of the fact that they, you know, we threaten their livelihood for some of them because now we're taking away overtime because of the fact that the statistics are going down. But obviously there are some black police officers who do live in these communities who appreciate what we do.
Thanks, Henry. Thanks for calling in and contributing today. Patricia from New York, how are you?
I'm just fine, thank you, Trace, and how are you?
I'm hanging in.
You don't have any other choice. And good afternoon to the PRN family. I actually just wanted to call in. I was listening to your conversation with Henry. And, in fact, the prosecutor did try to get Chauvin's records into the trial. He has been on the police force for about 20 years. And in those 20 years, he has had 17 complaints filed against him for excessive force, for use of excessive force. And in those 17, only one was he reprimanded for. So he has one complaint for almost each year that he has been on the force. the judge prohibited that his record, that information, from being introduced. I don't know why. There was no explanation for why he prohibited that information from coming in. I think there was some question about whether it would have been prejudicial towards him, although we know that whenever there is any kind of any kind of trial or investigation, the life of the person who has been traumatized and harmed is always brought out. So in this situation, for whatever reason, it was not allowed. But, you know, what's really interesting is that there is no one policing the police. And I give you an example. There was a gentleman who was released here in New York. He lived in Queens. He was incarcerated for 24 years for a crime that he did not commit. But what was interesting about this is that we have a new district attorney in Queens. The previous district attorney was Richard Brown. He passed away last year. He'd been district attorney for over two decades. And it was during his tenure that this individual was convicted. It turns out that because of the quote-unquote crime that existed in New York during the 80s, it was determined that whatever was necessary to get the job done would be done. And so there was this relationship, again, between the district attorney and the police. They withheld at trial, they withheld information that would have exonerated this gentleman. And it only recently came to light because the new district attorney has created a task force to investigate a lot of these cases. So while she should be commended for doing this, her explanation about this omission, this injurious and grievous omission to provide the defense of this man with this information, she said it was not criminal, it was inadvertent. That's her word. That's how she characterized the fact that they refused, they did not, as is required, turn over information to the defense attorney. So there's no, even when they recognize, that they do wrong, it's classified, it's characterized as inadvertent.
Well, of course, we're heading toward the big question, and that would be another day, as to what, if anything, will be done to look at this question more closely on the part of the people who are in charge, the people who make decisions about what is going to be done within the department as a whole.
And, you know, we talk about police, but judges are equal. We need to be talking about judges also, because let's face it, they're also a part of this. The police and district attorneys are culpable, but judges are equally at fault in the decisions that they make, and certainly in terms of sentences. So it's the entire system that is corrupt, the entire system, from head to toe.
Absolutely. I agree with you there. Thanks so much for calling in today and contributing.
Thank you, as usual,
very meaningfully. Gene from Maryland, you're on the air.
Hi, Idris. Good afternoon, and thank you for taking my call.
Thank you, Gene. Good afternoon to you, too.
So, Idris, I really liked Patricia's comment there, where she was mentioning that no one polices the police. And there's two points I wanted to make with you this afternoon. As we're following this trial of Derek Chauvin, it occurs to me that former President Donald Trump has a part in this. And you may recall when Jeff Sessions took the Attorney General's position, one of the things that he did was to relieve many of these police departments across the country of the burden of the consent decree, which basically turned them loose to do whatever they wanted with the understanding that the Justice Department would not step in under the guidelines of those consent decrees as they had been issued previously. And you'll recall, Donald Trump had given a speech, and he was very, very clear in the speech. And he said, and I'm quoting, "Don't be so nice. When you put the hand on the back of the head and you put the guy in the car,
yes,
don't be so nice." Now, the president speaks with the power of Article 2, and he gives permission for this kind of behavior to continue. And I think that that is something that we should really pay attention to as we look at this trial. My second point is we watched Chief Arredondo testify a day or two ago.
Yes.
And it occurs to me that he, as the leader of this police organization, holds a great deal of responsibility for his subordinates and their actions and the things that they're doing, the damage that they cause, and so forth, out in the field. And that the testimony that he gave was really more of a duck and cover move, as opposed to something where he was expressing his true feelings about the behavior of Derek Chauvin. I don't feel that that was quite as genuine as it appeared to be.
Please explain.
So, as chief of police, this is the individual who sets the policy and the tone at the top of the department. He is the one that approves the training regimen. He is the one that approves what the activities are going to be out in the street. He is the one that approves what levels of discipline are going to be applied based on the policies that are approved for the department. Now, I call that a duck and cover move because it seems on the one hand, and people are cheering because he's throwing Derek Chauvin under the bus. Now, I agree, Derek Chauvin should be under the bus, but it does try to shift the responsibility, not necessarily the blame, and this is a fine line between the responsibility and the blame, but it seems to shift the responsibility for the activity of an on-duty officer away from the supervisors and the structure of the police system there in Minneapolis and put it all firmly on Chauvin. Chauvin had a record. He had a long history of behavior. Now, the fact that the court wouldn't allow it to come in, I think, is a different issue. But with respect to a supervisor managing a subordinate, that record is very relevant. And so that's why I say this is a duck and cover move.
So as a duck and cover move, was he successful in ducking and covering?
With respect to the mainstream media, I think so. Because if you read some of the articles and watch some of the news broadcasts on television, everyone is so surprised and shocked that the chief of police would testify against a serving officer. How could that be? We've never seen that before in any of these cases. And again, while that may be true, we don't see those kinds of things. I mean, we didn't even see police, the brass, come out and testify against something as wild and crazy as Francis Livodi with what he did to Abner Louima.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, his testimony is unprecedented. I agree with that. But that doesn't do anything to move away from the idea that the department has some level of responsibility here. And that's why I bring up President Trump and the removal of the consent decrees across the country through Jeff Sessions?
I mean, you're right on the money, but I'm a little surprised that you missed the big issue here, the big move that was made. And that is the astute move to highlight the progress the police department has made. You have Arredondo, who is a person of color. You have others that they will come up with to present as a counterfoil to the question at hand, who is policing the police? And when Arredondo was produced, people went, oh, really? I forgot the name of the commentator right now, talked about how his jaw, he's a black man, he talked about how his jaw dropped. He was so moved. He was so surprised. He was so pleased of the participation of a person of color at that level in this case. So it means that there are other things working, and they're trying to utilize the moment to not only divert our attention, but also to nullify legitimate questions like those we're asking and answering today. But you offered us so much today, and I thank you. I thank you for that.
Okay,
thank you so much. You're welcome. You always have to pay attention, because there are any number of things working at the same time, all trying to capitalize on the moment, but trying also to get other things done without us knowing or without us seeing. The police department, not just in Minneapolis, but across the country, they are in the midst of trying to figure out how to do away with the old way of doing things, which is the way they're accustomed to doing things. How do you convince the public that you're more progressive now, that you're moving in the right direction, that you see a need to turn the page? And they're doing it. They're doing it by utilizing opportunities to highlight this supposed new progress that is being made. We have to be careful of that, because the old questions have not yet been answered. They have been asked, but they haven't been answered. What is the state of affairs? And it requires, I think, a national inquiry. What is the state of affairs? What is the state of play between white officers, predominantly, and others, especially people of color, within these various departments? How are they functioning? We should have open hearings about it. What is being achieved? And how do we explain that Derek Chauvin could still be on a force? How is that possible? And receive solid backing from a police group, even though he is no longer a cop, to the tune of in excess of $1 million to fund as many as 12 other lawyers to help him win this case. Really? That's okay? That sits well with those who are in the business of tending to the progress of these police organizations in our communities. And the communities have to start
having discussions among themselves as to what their taxpayer dollars get them. And is it worth it? What needs to happen to make things right? Thank you so much for listening and contributing as meaningfully as you always do. I am so proud to be your student, learning along with everybody else. We'll meet up again tomorrow. Let's do that. Bye-bye.